This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
For some time here in the U.S., the word refugees has been met with suspicion and more than a little fear. The 2016 election season and result didn't help that at all. But there are refugee families trying to assimilate and become more American. Now, a new book details a year in the life of some refugee children as they adjust to their new home in the U.S.
At the outset of the year, honestly, I couldn't even go up to the kids and explain to them, hi, I'm a journalist, I'm writing a book, and have them understand. That's how limited their English was.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about that book called The Newcomers. We'll also spend an academic minute with children learning English at home, but with an accent. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. There's a public high school in Denver, Colorado, that's accepting refugee teenagers and helping them learn English and become more American. And it's the subject of a powerful new book called The Newcomers. The book follows the lives of 22 immigrant teenagers throughout the course of the 2015-16 school year as they land at Denver's South High School in an English language acquisition class created specifically for them. Speaking no English and unfamiliar with American culture, their stories are poignant and remarkable as they face the enormous challenge of adapting to life in the U.S. The book is written by Helen Thorpe, an award-winning journalist who lives in Denver. Her work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The New Yorker, Texas Monthly, and 5280. She spoke about the book with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue.
How did you come to pick that high school, South High School in Denver, Colorado, and ultimately how you get in?
So another journalist in town who covers education and was really familiar with that high school advised me that that's where I should go if I was trying to write about refugee families. And the principal of the high school met with me happily because she knew my first book, and then she invited me to spend the year there. Honestly, I hadn't thought of even asking to spend a full year inside the school. She said, you know, if you wanted to spend time in any classroom here, you could. And I just started visiting this beginner-level English language acquisition classroom, and it was so fascinating to watch the teacher teaching English and just watching, you know, which kids were arriving, that the book idea came to me kind of in real time as I was sitting in the room. The kids who were showing up just mapped the refugee crisis. So, you know, the teacher got kids from the Democratic Republic of Congo and Burma and Iraq, all these countries that are sending a lot of refugees to the U.S. So it was amazing to see that happen.
You read about this, but it is obvious that most of the refugees that you are talking to at the beginning have very limited English skills. How did that relationship change and the communication change over time?
So yes, at the outset of the year, honestly, I couldn't even go up to the kids and explain to them, hi, I'm a journalist, I'm writing a book, and have them understand. That's how limited their English was. I ended up doing a couple of things. One is I just observed in their classroom as they were acquiring more and more English. But also, after the kids got settled, I hired interpreters and I met with them and explained in their home languages, here's who I am. I'm writing a book. If you want to participate, you can. And then the kids decided if they wanted to talk to me. Ultimately, I spent a lot of time with two brothers from the Congo and their family, and two sisters from Iraq and their mom, and got to know those families better at a deeper level, visiting them at home. And I kind of ended up writing about both a year inside the classroom, but also those families' journeys as the parents were trying to get jobs and work and, you know, be able to have their kids stay in high school learning English so that they could someday have much better jobs, different kind of work. I think the sacrifices, you know, that the parents made so their kids could be at school learning English, to me, were just incredibly moving. I'm a parent with a 15-year-old son, same age as their kids. And it was very moving for me to see parents taking jobs like working as a dishwasher or a maid, or in some cases, working in a meatpacking plant, very difficult kinds of jobs so that their kids could be in school learning English.
You talk about the two brothers that you followed from the Democratic Republic of Congo, Solomon and Methuselah. they come to school every day, and they're quick learners, aren't they?
Yeah, they learned at an extraordinary rate. I focused on them in part because the Congo is the country that has sent the most refugees to the U.S. in recent years, but also just because I was awed by their learning curve, and I think the teacher was too. And they learned so much English, I think, partly because so refugee kids can come from difficult situations, right? So they were coming from a war-torn part of the Congo, but nonetheless, their family was intact. They had both of their parents. They had all of their family members here. So even though they were coming out of a difficult place, they had an intact, stable, good family supporting them. And some of the other students in the room, by contrast, had also come from difficult places, but their families had been personally affected at an even deeper level. Many of the kids had lost one parent. There was even a student who showed up having lost both of his parents and was here alone. And so some of the other kids just needed more time to adjust if they had been more personally impacted, because trauma will slow down the rate of learning. But Solomon and Methuselah sailed forward, as you mentioned, and they, in their second year of school in the U.S., I saw them start reading To Kill a Mockingbird. And I never anticipated they were going to learn so much their first year, skip over a full year of instruction, enter mainstream classes like they did, and then start reading books like that in their second year. I just thought it was incredible to see.
As you were writing this story, an election was going on where a lot of very harsh language was coming out about the immigrant community. Did that have any impact on what you were writing and any impact on the students themselves?
Absolutely. The election rhetoric, I think, was deeply troubling to all the kids in the room. They were aware of it. They had trouble like following the intricacies of our election schedule. Like they would get confused by primaries and think the general election had just happened. And I'd explain to them, no, not yet. There's going to be more primaries before that happens. You know, we were going through the whole election calendar as their school year was unfolding. But what was troubling to them was this portrayal of refugees as like people to be afraid of. I mean, they had no animosity towards the U.S. They were incredibly grateful to, you know, to get a seat in this classroom, to be given a home here, a place that was safe for many of them, their first safe home that they could remember. And all they wanted was to become American as quickly as possible. They were just struggling to figure out, like, what do American kids wear to high school? And, you know, how do we fit into this society? And what's this weird stuff, spicy chicken that the cafeteria serves? Should I eat it or is it gross? You know, they wanted to assimilate and they were doing as best a job they could as fast as they could. But this idea that other people seem to have that they like wanted to hurt people here or were something to be afraid of was so dismaying for them. It was upsetting for them. They didn't want to be seen that way. Didn't represent the truth as they knew it.
I mentioned that you write about Solomon and Methuselah. You also write about Jacqueline and Miriam. These are two sisters from Iraq. They're dealing with the traumatic experience that brought them to this country, but they're really very charismatic kids, aren't they?
They are. I thought so, and I'm glad that comes across. Jacqueline and Miriam showed up in the classroom, and right away, I was kind of curious about them because one sister was wearing a headscarf covering her hair out of a sign of respect for God, and the other wasn't. And I was like, why is one sister covering her hair and one not? Like, are they both Muslim, or do they just like not think about Islam in the same way, or is one trying to assimilate to America more quickly than the other? I had all these sorts of questions. So I decided to spend time with them, and their family, you know, also became kind of main subjects, main characters in the book. So when I visited them at home, their mom explained that the girls were born right before this country invaded Iraq. And during the invasion of Iraq, their father, who was Christian, sided with the U.S. military. And he ultimately got a job as a bodyguard driving a member of the provisional government that we had backed around. And that judge in the provisional government was actually assassinated. And their father, the girl's father, was given death threats and targeted. So they fled from Iraq because they had sympathized with the U.S., and that meant Iraq wasn't safe for them anymore. And they went to a country where they thought they would be safe, but it was Syria. And no sooner did they settle in Damascus than the civil war there took over that country. And there were car bombings in their neighborhood. It became too unsafe to go to school. And so then they had to flee from Syria. So they were double refugees, basically. And they fled from Syria to Turkey. So, you know, by the time the girls made it to Denver here, they had been looking for a safe place to live for, you know, almost 10 years. So I had a lot of sympathy for their mom, who was now a single mom by the time she arrived in the U.S., because their dad ultimately had gone back to Iraq looking for work, and then he vanished. He was probably killed, they think. So here she is, a single mom in the U.S. with three daughters, Jacqueline and Mariam in high school, and another younger daughter in middle school. And her kids are having a really rough adjustment to the U.S., because, you know, people, when they ride the city buses, are calling them terrorists if they see Jacqueline's headscarf. And, you know, both Jacqueline and Mariam are struggling to explain, look, our dad's Christian, our mom's Muslim, we identify with both religions. And by the way, our dad sided with the U.S., but they don't have enough English to say this all to the people who are accosting them on the buses and whatnot. So very difficult entry for the girls here, harder, I think, than maybe any of the other students in the room, just because of, you know, the prejudice that we have or the fear that we have in this country about Muslims and terrorism, which their family had sided with us in the fight against terrorism, but we mistake them for an enemy. And that, to the girls, felt, you know, tragic, I think. They didn't want to be seen that way. That's not who they were. And it was hard for them to explain all of this, even to me, as sympathetic as I was, just given the communication issues. I had to hire an Arabic language interpreter and visit the family at home, not just one time, but like multiple times before their story became clear to me. And then, you know, of course, I empathized with their mom as a single mom struggling to keep her girls in school, but also I empathized with the girls and the reasons that they were sometimes rebelling or acting out or not wanting to go to school because they were just really struggling. And sometimes there were days when they stayed at home and didn't want to go to school. And, you know, as a parent, I understand how aggravated that makes their mom. She wants her kids in school, but it was hard for them. It was hard for them. They did acclimate successfully over time, but it took a long time in their case. So they didn't learn quite as quickly as, say, Solomon and Methuselah.
Still to come, Joe Donahue's conversation with Helen Thorpe continues with a look at a teacher who is the center of this story. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Helen Thorpe, an award-winning journalist who lives in Denver, Colorado. She's speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue about her new book called The Newcomers. It's a story about a Denver school that teaches refugee children English.
So sitting there watching all of this and playing a very big role in it is Eddie Williams, the teacher of the school. And he's kind of your guide through all of this, isn't he?
He's amazing, yes. He's the main character of the book, I would say, and he's kind of like holds the whole story together. So Eddie is 6'4" tall, a former soccer player at the college level, a former soccer coach turned teacher. And he kind of turned to teaching, like inspired by being a coach and watching players improve as he coached them. His dad, he has an Anglo name. His dad's Anglo. His mom's actually Latina. She had gone to English language acquisition classes as a child, and he was inspired by his mom's experiences. His mom had some negative experiences as a child learning English. She was made to feel ashamed of having been a Spanish speaker. So Eddie Williams is working really hard in his classroom to make sure that all of the kids in his room are treated with utmost respect by him, you know, by anybody else in the room. When he had me in his classroom, he kind of confronted me a little bit at one point and was like, look, I don't like you sitting off in the corner with your notebook, being an observer all the time. I would like for you to participate in the classroom. And I said, well, I'm a journalist and I think I need to keep a distance. Like, I'm not really supposed to become a participant. And he was like, yeah, we're building community in this room. So I'm going to just involve you in some lessons. And I think you should interact more with the kids. So, you know, I went back and checked with my editor. Is this okay? Can I do this? Am I, you know, crossing lines here as a journalist? And my editor said, yeah, a little bit, but just write about all of that and it will be fine. But I do think you're going to get to know the kids better this way. And that was true. I did. And the kids were like bringing over their notebooks and asking me to correct their homework or give them advice about exercises their teacher was asking them to do. And needless to say, I'm pretty good at English. I was an English major and right. a writer. So I was glad to advise. And it was fun. It was fun for me.
Give us a sense of how the takeaway from the story for you and the hopeful takeaway for readers in that a lot of Americans misunderstand the role of refugee children in this country. So with that said, what do you hope the takeaway is?
Well, my takeaway is these kids are stronger and more resilient than just about any kids I have ever seen. You know, as a mom with a 15-year-old, I know my kid is pretty strong and resilient, but he has not lived through circumstances anywhere near as hard as some of these students. And to see them, you know, land here, look around, get acclimated, figure out I'm in a safe place, maybe for the first time in my life, and I can really thrive here, that was awe-inspiring. I mean, the kids, you know, one of them ended up running on the track team. Another one ended up serving in student government during his second year in the U.S. after he got enough English. These are kids who want to give back and want to join our sports teams and join our forms of government and do everything and then some that their native-born counterparts are doing. And I think we underestimate refugees. We don't understand how strong they are. We have a bias. We tend to look down on them as like objects of pity. And if you spend time with them, that's not how you wind up feeling. I was looking up to them as examples of how strong human beings can be.
It is also fascinating that you really do get to understand of how easy it is for us to misunderstand other people.
Yeah, I write about that. I try to like let the reader look over my shoulder a little bit. I show the reader the mistakes that I made trying to understand these kids, trying to understand their parents. And of course, like slowly over time, we get to know each other a little bit better. Their English gets better. I get more used to working with all these different interpreters and we start to understand one another. But those misunderstandings, I mean, first of all, that's how we learn. But second of all, they're kind of funny. I mean, they're a little bit comical. I mean, I remember this one moment where one student, the track star, he's a kid from Eritrea. I had visited his church. And so first of all, the church service was 4 hours long. I'm not used to that.
Wow.
But at the end of it, he came up to me and gave me a crucifix because he was very thankful that I'd come to visit his church. And after he handed it to me, he got like a worried look on his face and he pointed to it as I was putting it on. He's like, "Miss, you know him?" I was like, "Yeah, this is Jesus." And he was like, "You know him?" I'm like, "Yeah, I know Jesus. I know who he is." And he was like checking to see, to be sure, like, did I know what a crucifix was? Because, you know, our communication was often fraught. And he was like wondering, have Americans heard of this man who's so important to me? Because half the time, you know, he'd be trying to communicate with Americans. We wouldn't know what he was talking about. So...
fascinating.
I thought that was really funny.
Again, the name of Helen Thorpe's new book is The Newcomers. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. Well, most American children learn English at home with their family, but what if a family member speaks with a foreign accent? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Do infants whose parents have different accents learn differently? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Marika Van Uchten, assistant professor of psychology at the University at Buffalo, discusses the answer.
When we study language development, we often look at when the average child reaches particular milestones. But this does not take into account the tremendous differences in language input, even between monolingual children. For example, an American English-speaking mother might call that yellow vehicle that takes children to school a bus. But the same word spoken by an Irish English-speaking father might sound more like boss. These parents label the same object in the same language, but the child still needs to work out how to map those different pronunciations to the same referent. Now, our research suggests that infants raised in homes where they hear a single language, but spoken with different accents, recognize words dramatically differently at about 12 months of age than children of the same age exposed to little or no variation in accent. Crucially, this was found even though the two groups of children were matched on the number of words they know. So both groups of children are learning words at about the same rate, but hearing multiple accents at home changes how children recognize words, at least in lab settings. Because of this, my co-author and I conclude that monolingual children should not be viewed as a uniform group, as children who hear multiple accents process language differently than those who hear a single accent. And this is important if you think about clinical settings where children are tested. Speech-language pathologists typically speak in the local variant of the language, but if you have a child growing up in an environment with more than one accent, then we might need to have different expectations for that child.
That was Marika Van Uchten of the University at Buffalo. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.